Good afternoon. My name is Alicia, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Bottom Line Financing Energy Efficiency Purchasing Renewable Energy conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press the pound key. Thank you. I would now like to turn the call over to Ms. Gina Puglisi, Vice President, Premier Safety Institute. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, Alicia, and good afternoon, and welcome to Premier's Advisor Live telecast, as Alicia said, called Improving Operating Margins with Energy Efficiency and New Purchasing Strategies. Our program is part of the Energy Leadership Forum, and this is the first in a series of five programs that's going to discuss the bottom line and business case for energy management. I'm Gina Puglisi, and I'm going to be the moderator for today's program. I just have a few quick announcements before we get started. This teleconference is being recorded and will be posted to the Advisor Live homepage at premierinc.com about 24 hours after the call. The slides are already available on the website. Look for an email right after this call that's going to let you know how to access today's materials, and there'll also be a link to a very brief evaluation about today's program, and we really encourage you to complete the evaluation, and we value your feedback. Okay, so our Energy Leadership Forum is part of Premier's energy program, Sphere, which is designed to help healthcare facilities reduce their energy use, the cost, their carbon footprint, and also to increase the use of clean and renewable energy. And today we're going to talk about how Geisinger doubled their campus size without increasing energy demand and also saved $3 million. We're also going to talk about funding options and return on investment on specific energy projects. And we're also going to hear about how Ingalls saved $800,000 using a reverse auction for energy purchasing and renewable energy to reduce their carbon footprint. I'd like to now introduce Nick DeDominicus. Nick is the director of the Healthcare Clean Energy Exchange at Practice Green Health, and they are a nonprofit membership organization founded on the principles of positive environmental stewardship and best practices by many organizations in the healthcare community. And Practice Green Health has partnered with Premier in offering the reverse auction for energy procurement to help hospitals reduce their cost of energy and also to hopefully help them increase their use of renewable energy. Nick's going to introduce our speakers, and he's also going to be available during the question and answer period. Nick?
Thank you, Gina. Today our first presenter will be Al Nooner. He's the Associate Vice President of Facility Operations at Geisinger Health System. Al oversees Geisinger's 4 million square foot of physical space, and he and his team devised a creative strategy at their main campus to manage energy resources that reduced overall energy utilization while the physical plant expanded by more than 50%. Geisinger is a known, recognized leader in healthcare committed to the green building movement and recently received a silver LEED rating for their new Center for Health Research. The second speaker today will be Mr. Vince Pryor. Vince is the Chief Financial Officer and Chief and Corporate Vice President of Finance for Ingalls Healthcare Systems in Harvey, Illinois. And in his role, Vince has oversight responsibilities for finance, accounting, budgets, information systems, managed care, materials management, medical records, and employee benefits. Vince is known for finding creative and innovative ways to keep operating to improve operating margins, and he viewed the reverse auction for energy procurement as yet another way to save Ingalls some money. So with that, I'd like to introduce Al.
Thank you, Nick. Welcome to rainy Danville, PA. We've already pretty much covered, you know, what the gist of our presentation is, and that is that we had significant campus growth, about 75%, without increasing our utility usage or cost. And the net result of that is about $3 million in energy savings. We're going to talk a little bit about how we accomplished that and how we came about that. We really started this endeavor back with the last financial crisis that we found ourselves in the early 90s, and decided that it was our only alternative for the engineering side of the operation. Instead of reducing manpower, we decided we would make savings in energy, so we didn't have to have manpower cuts since we already felt we were short. So we view this, as far as saving energy, as be part of our mission. Since the saving of energy reduces the pollutants emitted from power plants, and it also improves public health. You can actually quantify this if you go to NIC's website on the Clean Energy Exchange, put in your utility usage, and get a health effect on a population and actually implied cost, societal costs as well as direct medical costs. So I recommend that you do that. The first thing we want to talk about is the cost of ownership in buildings, because really the first opportunity to save energy is when you build a building, and it's actually the best opportunity because you're buying new equipment anyway. And one of the things that I've always noticed is that the project budget always determines what you end up with in energy-consuming equipment, your chillers, your air conditioning systems, lighting, and that's really the tail wagging the dog. If you look at this chart, you'll see that actually the cost of construction, the capital cost of the building, is only about 11% of the total cost of ownership over 40 years, while the operating expense of that building is about 50%. So being, you know, spending your upfront money wisely in the construction process and getting the extra dollars if you need it to upgrade systems is by far the best investment you can make. This slide is just an example of some of the projects that we've undertaken to reduce our energy usage. We will go through a sampling of these projects in more detail, but this is the kind of record keeping we do to track our expenditures and our savings and how we come up with the $3 million a year savings. You'll see this only totals to 2.2 because it's not been updated for a bit. The other thing that's been pretty dramatic is, and it's very easy to see, is that we haven't increased our electrical demand. And that's pretty incredible considering we had been all absorption cooling as well as having added 8,000 PCs to the campus. So conversion from absorption, which is steam-driven, to electric, we've seen actually no impact because of the other efficiencies we've gained. As we talked before, Nick mentioned that we did receive a LEED Silver for our Center for Healthcare Research. We've also recently received a LEED Gold for a clinic facility in State College. And we've got two buildings right now awaiting certification, a four-story patient tower in Wilkes-Barre that we're anticipating to be LEED Silver, and a nine-story addition in Danville that we also anticipate to be LEED Silver. So again, that is the best time to make the investments in energy savings equipment. Make sure the buildings you're building are as efficient as you can get them. The first project we undertook, actually, that for savings was converting our electrical point of contact with the utility, moving from a 12,000-volt contact point to 69,000-volt. You'll see there that at the time had generated us $250,000 in rate savings for a little over $500,000 project. Electrical distribution, we're going to move pretty quickly here because we've got 30 slides to cover in 30 minutes. So we did an electrical distribution upgrade. Now, normally you would think, how would that generate savings? Well, by redoing our whole distribution network, we found we had 20 amps going to ground at 12,400 volts. And if you translate that out, that's $50,000 a year savings. Now, normally that is not a project that you would do as an energy savings project. We needed to do it anyway. But, you know, we do take credit for it because it was an actual savings to us. That's just normally a typical infrastructure project. The one project, if you haven't done it, and I know many places I go into have not, is a lighting project, and the reason these projects are so significant is that there's absolutely zero financial risk to them. there's no way you can't save the money. If you're replacing a fixture that's consuming 138 watts, let's say, with a fixture or just relamping it and rebalancing it and now consuming 65 watts, you have to save that differential 62 watts every hour that fixture is lit. So it's a very low-risk project. It was significant to us because when we did the project on campus here, we actually saw our demand decrease 1 megawatt. And this is a project that we actually did under an operating lease. We'll talk a little bit more about financing later. But it's a good scenario for that because really there's no out-of-pocket expense. So we structured that operating lease so that the lease expense was $300,000 a year, and we had net annual savings of $460,000, giving us essentially the difference between those, or $160,000 net positive cash flow during that lease period. Since cooling is a large percentage of, at least for most places, of your energy costs, we really took a look at how we should cool the buildings. And what you'll see here is a relative cooling cost for us at our utility rates that we were experiencing at the time for different cooling systems. You'll see low pressure absorber, high pressure absorber, turbine absorber, combination electric chiller, and an off-peak electric. We, as I said previously, we had converted from the low pressure absorber, which you see there was 9 cents a ton, to electric chillers, which was about 3.5. So that's a savings of nearly 6 cents for every ton of cooling we make, and we generally run somewhere around 3,000 tons of cooling per hour. And then you'll see the last option is electric off-peak, which is something we'll talk about also that we've just implemented. So here's what the project looks like for replacing absorbers with chillers. We saw annual savings of about $360,000 on an initial investment of about $750,000. The next thing I want to talk about is thermal lift. And I know that not all the folks on the call are engineers, but I've tried to make this simple enough that you can see it. Essentially, the efficiency of cooling system is dependent upon the amount of work that the systems, the mechanical systems, have to do. So in this case, we're going to look at a chiller. And you'll see there at the bottom of those walls is 42 degrees, and that's normally the temperature of chilled water that's made in chilled water systems. The temperatures at the top of the wall, you'll see 85 and 75, represent the condensing temperatures that the chiller needs to overcome. So in other words, that's the temperature that the cooling towers are set at. And many times when I walk into facilities, I see folks operating their towers at 85 degrees, which is what manufacturers recommend. And they don't really recommend that, but that's the setting that they have all the, it's the design point of the chiller. So it makes it easy for their techs to evaluate what the chiller is doing at those temperatures. But many people think that's where they should operate them. In reality, the lower we set that condensing water temperature, the less work we have to do, and that's really represented by the difference in the height of the walls, okay? So obviously, for this guy to scale the wall, it's a lot easier for him to get over to a 75-degree wall than it is 85, and that translates directly into savings in making chilled water. Rule of thumb for that is for about every degree I decrease that condensing temperature, I save about 2% of the energy that the chiller consumes. The beauty of that is that also at the lower condensing temperatures, if the chiller is not at if it is at capacity, I actually pick that up in additional capacity. So in other words, if I have a 1,000-ton chiller and I lower the condensing temperature 10 degrees, I will actually get 1,200 tons out of that chiller. So something to bear in mind when you're looking at cooling plants. Cooling towers is another opportunity within that, since chilling is such a large expense. And most towers that are designed for buildings are designed with a 10 to 12 degree approach temperature. Now, since cooling towers work by evaporating water, that approach temperature, what that means is the temperature you will get out of the tower as compared to the wet bulb temperature outside. We actually went through and replaced all our cooling towers with 5-degree approach towers. So right off the bat, we pick up 5 degrees in condensing temperature, which again relates to 10% of the cooling cost. And then secondly, you'll notice on this style tower, there's no louvers on the side. That's because this is a counterflow tower. And just a tip here, most places I see have crossflow towers. However, a counterflow tower only uses about 1/3 the fan horsepower of a crossflow. So there's an additional pretty significant savings associated with moving to counterflow besides going to a lower approach temperatures. When we started this, you know, we had absorbers in almost every building, and what we ended up doing is connecting all our buildings together and essentially made a centralized cooling system. The significance of that is that the cooling loads in different buildings, because of their exposures, because of their occupancies, don't all coincide. So the larger you make chilled water systems, the less the incremental increases in tonnage demand as you expand buildings. So if you don't have centralized systems, you know, there's ways to work towards that by joining together independent systems. That's really how we started all this. The next area we'll talk about is variable frequency drives. Now, essentially, variable frequency drives is a means of controlling the speed of a motor relative to the load it needs to produce or whatever it's serving, whether it be a fan, a pump, or whatever. So in this case, let's look at a 100 kW motor, and at 100% of the flow, it's still going to consume 100 kilowatts of power. However, the beauty of VFDs is as we start backing the flow down, or the speed of the motor, if you will, look at what happens to the kilowatts. At a mere 20% reduction in flow, we save half the power. To further look at that, let's look at 50% of the flow. We are now only consuming 12.5% of the power that we did if we didn't have a VFD on that motor. All right. So, I mean, significant savings by retrofitting air handlers, pumps, fans, exhaust systems, wherever anything's got a motor on it, generally it can be controlled by a VFD as long as you have a variable flow situation. And that's a conversion you need to consider because we run a lot of more horsepower in a hospital. Even to the point that we have the things on our medical air pumps, vacuum pumps, any piece of equipment we can put them on. And really, mathematically, the power savings are the cube of the flow reduction, and this is how we get to these numbers. These are some of the different VFD applications to consider. You know, we had been on this site, and actually at all sites, as many are, constant flow chilled water systems. We have converted all our chilled water systems to variable flow, either by gagging off the return port on a three-way valve or by replacing them with two-way valves. Our boiler feed pumps, interesting scenario there. We used to run a 30-horsepower motor for each boiler. We now run one VFD 15-horse motor to supply two boilers. So, you know, again, a savings of 45 horsepower just in that instance. And you'll see some other examples here. Waterside economizers. This doesn't work in all climates. It does work probably in the northern half of the states. But essentially what this is it's a heat exchanger that sits in place of a chiller so that when we have favorable outdoor air conditions, and again, many air handlers have full economizer on them, which will draw in outside air to cool. But in this case, what we're doing, because we have spaces that are not adequately cool without mechanical cooling year-round, we run what's called a waterside economizer. And what that is the blue thing you see in the middle there is a plate and frame heat exchanger cooled on one side by condenser water. And then the white piping you see is actually chilled water. And so what happens is when outdoor air temperatures drop let's say, below 40 degrees, we turn off the chillers. We depress our cooling tower temperatures to about 45 degrees on our condenser circuit, and then directly cool the chilled water with the condenser water with no mechanical cooling. We find that we can operate a system like this somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 hours a year in our climate. And, of course, that will vary based on how far north you are. Air handler replacement, we've methodically moved through air handlers, realized that on our site we have buildings dating to 1915. We see about, on average, and let's say a typical air handler is probably, let's assume 10,000 CFM, about $5,000 in savings from improved performance and, lower pressure head on the fans, improved cooling, and plus DDC control, which is a significant savings on them. Condensate recovery, although it's not particularly an energy saving system, it is a huge environmental impact. And what we do is, what you're seeing at in front of you is merely a spill containment pallet, like what you could buy from New Pig for, maybe $125 or so, with a little sump pump. And we actually put these on our air handlers so that all the condensate that the air handler generates in the summer months, we reclaim that water and use it for cooling tower makeup. That saves us about 14 million gallons of water a year. The beauty of it is it's absolutely pure water, since it is condensate. So the water requires very little chemical treatment, because there is no calcium or hardness in it. And also it's very cold water, since it's generally coming out at the air handler discharge temperature, which is somewhere in around 52 to 55 degrees, which also helps the condenser circuit, since we're not putting warmer water in. But an ingenious little solution, and has paid huge dividends. And, of course, we always end up getting at least one leads point on our buildings by doing this for water conservation. Medical air, we talked a little earlier about VFDs. This is a VFD medical air compressor. What's unique about it is that, of course, in healthcare, we need to have desiccant dryers. And when we have desiccant dryers for medical air, we need to purge the moisture out of them, which means that if we have a typical system, we lose 15% of our air due to purge. And then on top of that, we have to heat the air, to purge that desiccant to get the moisture out of it. This is a compressor system that actually has no purge air. The purge from the desiccant is actually inducted back into the first stage of the compressor, and we drop the moisture out in the intercooler, and there is no additional heat. The heat used to recharge the desiccant is done with waste heat from the compressor. So probably about $10,000 to $15,000 a year operating savings. We actually have three of these 50 horsepower units installed. We typically run one loaded, but it's a significant savings when you look at it compared to a typical medical air drying system. Vacuum pump, same scenario. We used to have water-cooled pumps, went to high-efficiency pumps, eliminated the water, which actually improves our reliability, because when you had a water-sealed pump, you, of course, are dependent upon two utilities, and the loss of either will create a failure or an outage. So we had an investment of $70,000 and a savings of roughly $10,000 on this type of project. And again, all these utilities have been made into centralized system. I probably should have covered it under the medical air, but when we started, we probably had, each building had its own medical air system. We now run roughly 2 million square feet on those three medical air pumps. So we've agglomerated all these systems into single systems for the same type of diversity savings that we see with chilled water. boiler upgrade. This is a hugely significant project. And realize that the savings we're talking about here was probably 7 years ago on natural gas. That was $3. Although it's almost back to that now. But we had boilers that were 30-plus years old. We did extensive testing on the mechanicals, the tubes, and decided rather than replace the boilers, we would merely go through and do a burner retrofit and change and improve the control system on them. And so what you're seeing there are German burners. The savings overwhelmed us. We weren't anticipating that level of savings. But that's what it turned out to be. Now, imagine last year when we were paying $12 for gas, that actual savings for last year would have been four times that amount in fuel. So, very significant project. While we were in the boiler plant, of course, we had already talked about doing the variable frequency boiler feed pumps. We also thought, well, maybe we can do heat recovery on the blowdown water. And then started questioning ourselves, well, why do we blow down? And came to the conclusion, instead of doing blowdown heat recovery, let's just make ultra-pure water and not have to blow the boilers down. So the only blowdown we do on the boilers now is a bottom blow once a day, just to get any precipitants out, any iron or anything that accumulates in the bottom. And this is probably worth in us about $15,000 a year between the heat we save as well as the water savings. Incinerator replacement, we're just going to skip over that. Yeah, we used to have one, and there's other ways to do that. We do treat the waste at this site for every entity we own, which is about 60 sites, so we're a licensed hauler and transporter. Steam trap monitoring, highly recommended. Interesting story with this. After we installed it, as I went through mechanical rooms, I was seeing, as you see here, there's lights that indicate whether traps are in trouble or not, and I was finding way too many traps in trouble. So at a department meeting, just merely put it out to the guys that, look, I anticipated $50,000 of savings, a one-year payback. I'm going to get it, and it's either going to be through this trap system or in manpower, so your call. And after that, our compliance went way up, and that system functions fine. Now the guys respond to it. We talked a little bit in cooling about off-peak cooling. We've just constructed a million-gallon chilled water storage tank. It is 8,000 ton-hours. So in essence, we can have a 1,000-ton load off-peak for 8 hours. What this does, we're in the midst of adding a 334,000-square-foot building without increasing our chiller capacity. So with the tank, we've been able to absorb that kind of load without any additional, if you will, mechanical capital expenditure. The other thing this has actually bought us is for those of you that are in states that have that are deregulated on electricity, this has allowed us to participate in a demand reduction program put on by PJM. And in essence, we get paid $48,000 to take a megawatt off of demand, by shut our demand by a megawatt by turning this tank on upon a call from them. And then at that point, we will also receive $100 a megawatt hour for the number of hours we're off. So a pretty decent way to get a return off of this type of device. UPS systems, I know many people run UPS either for ORs, MRIs, UPSs, cath labs. What we've learned is that many times we've seen multiple installations of UPSs. We run UPS as a central utility. To give you an example, we run a UPS similar to this in a 900N+1 configuration, which would mean the capacity of that unit is 900 kVA. We have got all our imaging, all our ORs, and everything else hooked to that unit. So we have a connected load of 3,600 kVA. And we've just barely dented the capacity of this unit, even though the unit's only rated at 900. And the reason for that, as we talked before with chiller systems and everything else, is system diversity. We've got to talk just for a second about financing things. You know, times are tough. Investments are not paying, you know, for the healthcare systems. And we got into this before is when we did our lighting project, we opted to lease it, to do an operating lease. There's advantage to that. That's something you really need to talk to your CFO about, whether you allow capital leases, operating leases, and how they're structured. I will talk just briefly on performance contracts, and that is, I know people who have used performance contracts for a lighting project, for instance. That is something I would not recommend, mainly because you tend to want to use a performance contract when you have a questionable outcome, when you're not absolutely certain. Since the risk is so low on a lighting project, it really doesn't make sense to use a performance contract, because part and parcel to that performance contract is an insurance policy that you're paying for, you know, to assure that you get those savings. And as we discussed before with lighting, there's no way you can't get the savings, so don't waste your money with something like that. So, conclusions. You know, we've actually rolled this into a program where we actually take these utility savings and reinvest them. We were able to convince our financial management that that was the appropriate thing to do. Expanding centralized systems, we can increase capacity without increasing our demand due to diversity of the buildings and by agglomerating these systems. And lastly, you know, when you're building these buildings, go for LEED type accreditation so that you're always getting the most efficient systems possible. Spending that upfront money correctly will pay you dividends throughout the life of the building. Okay. At that, I think I'm ready to turn it over to Vince.
Well, thank you. I'm going to be speaking today on the reverse auction for energy procurement that we implemented. And it's been a little bit of a journey the last nine months. We've actually first started talking about 9 months ago and got it implemented very quickly, and now I've been talking about what we've done in a lot of different segments of the marketplace since then. A little bit about Ingalls Health System. We are in the southern suburbs of Chicago. It's a glorious 50-some degrees today here, sun shining. It's amazing. Not usually that way in Chicago at this time of year. But we are a 563-bed hospital with multiple network facilities. When I say that, we have three major outpatient facilities, which we call family care centers, which are each one of them approximately 80,000 square feet, and I would probably best describe them as outpatient hospitals. And you can see everything else that we have on within our system. When we looked at the objectives of what we were looking at trying to accomplish, we were looking at trying to, first and foremost, reduce our costs and save some money in this arena. We were looking at trying to purchase some renewable energy, a percentage of that, and look at what the impact of maybe trying to get to a clean energy percent of 5% would mean for the community. And then obviously with the outcomes of the first two hopefully being positive, we were looking to try to get some positive publicity in our community as well as enhance reputation in this arena. When we first started talking about this, which was probably about June or July during 2008, we were really facing what we all were experiencing, a very volatile energy market. Our gas prices, as Al had alluded to, were very high in the $10 to $12 range, and really where we were going was going to be questionable of what we could be able to save. We see there was growing need to divert cost away from what we're really in business to do, and that's provide quality, safe health care. And you can read the rest of some of the crisis size that we were looking at. When we looked at the, when Premier came and talked to us about the SPEAR reverse auction proposal, really it was built as a new way to look at the purchase of energy, and that they had experience, through the partnership with World Energy and everyone else, trying to really accomplish some savings and increase all the good things we've talked about already. So what is a reverse auction? In a traditional auction, basically buyers compete for a product or service, whereas in this reverse auction, the sellers of that energy is actually competing for our business. The one way I like to describe it is if you've ever bought anything on eBay or bid on eBay, think about the fact that it's really using that concept, but really having the suppliers bid for how much energy that we have to offer or that we're going to purchase in X period of time, whether that be 1, 2, 3 years or longer for electricity, and usually gas is done more in blocks of 5 months to 18 months, depending upon whether you want to go for the full year plus a winter or just one winter in that auction. And the primary purpose of any reverse auction is to drive the price downward. We believe it outperforms the traditional paper-based approaches because it really strips out the premium that the suppliers are trying to accomplish, and at the same time allows us to bid renewable energy against non-renewable energy to really market the two against each other. And that really was a key for us because it allowed us to get renewable energy at a more cost-effective price than even the non-renewable energy. So it really matched the two against each other, and it was set in such a time-focused approach that it really made people have to get aggressive if they wanted the business. So how does it work? Basically, first we signed an agreement, or rather we didn't, but the entities that the suppliers had to sign an agreement to participate in the auction, and we had to provide the utility data in order for them to do that. There was an electronic RFP developed that was sent out to the suppliers, and all those suppliers had to be pre-qualified in order to verify participation. They also sent to us all of their contracts up front before the auction started so that we could review their contracts, in-house counsel, and so forth, and identify if there was deal breakers that just couldn't get passed, that regardless of what the price would be, that we wouldn't sign the agreement. So then we could either modify that agreement or just tell them there's no use participating, either way. And both occurred during our experience. We conducted the reverse auction event. If you look at it, we originally did it for electricity, and the suppliers get to log on to the auction site and bid over a 15 to 30 minute period for each RFP. As an example, for electricity, we did 17 different RFPs based upon how much green energy we were looking for, how much the time frame. So we originally started with looking at it being only buying what they call brown energy, which would be not non-renewable, and we did year 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and then we went out and we bid green energy at 5%, years 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, green energy at 10%, years 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and then just an index pricing for a couple options. And I think the key to why we were successful, particularly in getting green energy at less costly amount than brown energy, was that we were able to set the bar for where brown energy was. So anybody that was bidding green energy knew they had to come in under that amount, and they actually did. So we got 5% green at a lower price than 100% brown energy, and it worked quite well for us. And the final prices really did reflect the market at the moment in time. The other key to this process is that you have to execute the transaction the same day. So in our case, the auction took place from about 9 until 11 in the morning. Then we closed out the auction, had everybody's bids, and we actually then, between 11 and 1, finalized signing all the contracts and all of the documents in order to execute. And that's the guarantee that you give the supplier, is that you will execute the same day. Now, earlier it was mentioned in one of the slides that this is really risk-free. And what does that mean? Well, In essence, the healthcare exchange works with the hospital before the auction occurs to evaluate the opportunity, the market conditions, really to try to figure out what are the strategies, the timing we want to go to market, and what should we expect to see. And from our experience here at Ingalls, at least, they were pretty accurate in what we should expect and what we should recognize. Even with that being said, though, at the end of the auction, which you will have to identify the lowest bidder, we can compare that against the current market. We don't have to execute that contract that day. We can choose not to execute if we're not satisfied, or we can execute. The other point that I'll make out is that with gas, particularly when we did gas about 10 days later, we didn't buy the lowest bid for varying reasons. We actually went with the second lowest bid, which was within pennies of each other, but there was things that we liked about the contract better with that bidder versus the other one. So the hospital makes a final decision on who you contract with and whether you contract or not. So from our standpoint, it was pretty much risk-free on the contracting component. So what was the truth of the results? From the electricity side, we saved $375,000. And on natural gas, we had a $465,000 savings. Electricity, that $375,000 was over 3 years, and gas, the $465,000, was over a 18-month period. So we had some pretty strong results in both these areas. On the electricity, we were able to get the 5% renewable source or green energy, and what that translated to, it was elimination of 3,400 tons of carbon dioxide per year, and a little bit over 10,000 tons over the three-year agreement for electricity. So we felt that was very successful. From a public health impact, there's a energy impact calculator on the website that Practice Green Health can help you try to figure out what that is. For Ingalls, the 5% renewable energy translated into the reductions as shown on this slide of sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxide, and so forth. But it's a pretty neat calculator that really goes through and translates everything into actual numbers for you, quantifiable. And that energy impact calculator, as I mentioned, is located on the Practice Green Health website. The website is listed there. And basically anyone can use it. It's pretty easy to calculate through, so I'd suggest you go on there and at least play with it a little bit and see. All you have to do is enter your kilowatts, and it generates a report. And it really helps put energy into health impact terms. And we've used that a lot in the community, trying to have everyone understand what it is that we were able to accomplish. You know, from our standpoint, we had gotten pretty tired of doing the same process over and over, and you felt like you basically got the same answer. It just was a different flavor a little bit up, a little bit down. There wasn't a lot of ability to really feel like you could drive the process. And I think with the reverse auction, from our perspective, we became in control of the process rather than just being a byproduct of what the market was going to drive us to. It really came from our whole senior administrative team was really interested in this. During the auctions, which both lasted about 2 hours, I think during that time period, every single one of the executive team wandered in just to watch because it was pretty interesting. We put it up on the big screen and watched live as everything worked through the web with the pricing going up. You would see each bidder come in lower and lower and lower, and for the term of the auction, whether it was anywhere from 5 to 10 minutes individually, you could see the 7 or 8 suppliers continuing to bid down the price. And it was kind of intriguing to watch that. We were able to establish a very cross-functional team. In the past, in our shop, it had primarily been plant operations that kind of drove this process, working in coordination with myself. But in this case, we involved others, including materials management, to try to coordinate what really made sense for us in regard to not only the price we were paying, but also the term we wanted to go out. Because we looked upon, you know, particularly electricity is something, if we could lock up for 3 years and know approximately what we're going to have to pay every year, that was something that, that we would not have to worry about, and it moved it from a uncontrollable expense to more of a known factor. So that was attractive to us, why we went 3 years out versus shorter term. Probably weren't comfortable going longer than 3 years, but we felt that we were successful going that distance. Be honest with you, in regard to our director of plant operations, it probably moved him out of his comfort zone because it was doing something different and moving it more into the what I might call the financing arena of making investment decisions, because that's really pretty much what you're talking about, is making an investment decision. And you have to challenge the longstanding practices, and that's something at Ingalls that we continually do, because we do service a what many would consider a depressed market that causes us to have to focus a lot on what we can do with our limited resources. So we do challenge existing practices in an effort to not only save money but also to help the community that we serve. And we are an owner in Premier, and we have a longstanding relationship with them, and feel that they have brought opportunities to us that we've pioneered, and vice versa. And I think it's been good for us as well as Premier in that regard. From a publicity standpoint, I probably this went far beyond anyone's expectations. We've gotten written up in Time Magazine, Healthcare Finance, Materials Management, and Healthcare, and you can see a few of the others, as well as we were recently written up in Modern Healthcare, and I just heard Data Management today that we were written up in. So we have been getting a fair amount of press on this, and I guess that's good. As a finance guy, it's hard to attribute dollars to that, but I think it does help our institution. Who should participate? Obviously, I think if you're looking at ways to reduce your cost structure and save money, it's something that you should look at, particularly since the risk is extremely low in regard to at least looking at it, pursuing it. For us, an important component beyond just saving the money was locking in more stable pricing, so we would know what that would look like. And then the purchasing of green renewable energy is important. Now, in order to be really successful with this, you have to be located in a state that's deregulated, and your energy contracts need to be expiring within the next 12 months in order to really be that effective. The one thing I will point out here, though, in regard to locking things up, this isn't a one-shot-and-done arrangement. We've actually gone back, particularly at gas, because we originally set up gas for a shorter period of time, and within the last 60 days, we've actually extended that and went out and bought further because of what's happened to the price of gas, and we've actually feel that we've saved money beyond what was shown on a previous slide, because we've locked down gas for about another 12 months. So we're pretty excited about that also. So it is a continual process that you can work and try to make decisions on. Some of the competitive markets on this slide talks about where hospitals have a choice. You'll see that where there's current competitive markets for electric, as well as markets that are going to be emerging for the competitive electric market. Nearly all states are deregulated for natural gas, which provides opportunities in the local marketplace. And this is basically a slide color-coded here that kind of shows you a little bit on one slide what the competitive markets look like. I'll let you peruse that yourselves. And with that, I'd just like to thank you for the opportunity to share our story and turn it back over to Gina.
Thank you very much, Nick and Al and Vince, for your presentations. This concludes our presentation, and now we'd like to invite everyone to listen and or to ask questions on what we've heard today. Operator, could you please instruct everyone on how to register a question?
If you would like to ask a question during this time, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, that's star, then the number 1. Your first question comes from Dwight Duckstein.
I just wondered, I'm in a non-competitive state for electric. I can do something with natural gas, but is there a rule of thumb below which your size of facility just doesn't warrant the effort that it takes to accomplish this, kind of the law of diminishing returns type thing?
Nick, I'm going to turn that question over to you.
I think I turned my mute off. Can folks hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes, for natural gas, you want to have about a $2 million or more in terms of annual gas costs.
Well, thankfully, that leaves me out.
Are you associated with other facilities in the same area?
Just one other facility, yes. It wouldn't come up with that much revenue, I don't think.
Okay. If it's the same legal entity and they're located in the same area, in some cases there are opportunities to aggregate the load.
This isn't even under the same legal entity. We just have a partnership agreement.
Okay. Yeah, the reverse auction is used for higher volumes.
Okay, that's what I thought.
I will give you a phone number for any specific questions about the reverse auction that you might have, in addition to questions you may ask on today's call. And you can call my number at 704-733-5865. And that would be, we'd be able to take questions and get back to you for any specific questions on that. Next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Robert Hajar.
Yeah, in your savings, I'm not sure which slideshow it was. In the savings, what did we calculate the cost per kW at when we showed the savings?
Nick, can you answer that?
You know, I don't have the information. If I recall, I'm doing this from memory because I don't have the data with me, but we were in the 8 to 9 cent range, and what Ingalls chose to do, and Vince, please correct me if I'm wrong, they chose to calculate savings against what they had projected as the budget. And so that's what the savings were calculated on. And I think in the Illinois market, they were playing around at a commodity cost of between 7 and 8 cents, but I don't have that data right handy, right with me right here. I can provide that information to you if you need it.
You're pretty close on those numbers, if not right on. If we had calculated the savings off of the current run rate and not the budget, the savings would have gone up by about $150,000, $200,000.
Yeah.
Because we did anticipate within the budget that we were going to see some savings.
And that's actually a good point, because some organizations take a look and they try to compare performance against the current market price. Other organizations might be more comfortable comparing what they had budgeted for costs, which might actually be based on a projection of what they thought the market price would be at the time that they had to go out for procurement. So each individual organization needs to kind of think through that and how to actually evaluate the performance of it. Ingalls chose to do it against projected budget.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Lynn Dillavo. Lynn, your line is open. The question has been withdrawn. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad at this time.
While we're waiting for the next question, just to remind everyone, on the website where the slides are available, there are a number of documents, including some articles and from Geisinger and Al Neuner, and case studies from both Geisinger and Ingalls that you can download and review, and there's also detailed information about the energy impact calculator that Vince mentioned. We also have a full website for our Sphere Energy program at premierinc.com/sphere. And on that website, we have lots of case studies from a variety of different organizations on energy saving and tools and resources and tips for energy conservation. There's also a chart on the website that lists all the states that are deregulated by state.
Hey, Gina, I have a question. Can I ask it in this mode?
Sure.
This question's for Al. Al, what were the challenges and what do you think the key reason or the key to success of convincing leadership to take a look, take a hard look at life cycle cost versus capital cost and when you pursued some of your new construction projects?
Well, it's always return on investment, Nick. And, I mean, I think the thing that's most successful is that, particularly now with markets down, I mean, healthcare systems are sitting there with some amount of reserves that they're not getting the return on investment that they had certainly budgeted. But even in good times of the market, when we have a project that's, let's say, at the outside giving us a five-year return on investment, that's the equivalent of, that's a 20% return. But generally what I like to do with those numbers is turn them around and convert them to revenue.
Yeah.
And you do that by dividing the 20% into it. So in other words, you know, if we have a project that saves $100,000, that's equivalent of some venture that the healthcare system would have of an investment of $500,000 in additional revenue. So, it's really showing that there is a return, that this is the best thing for the long term, and it's really the lowest risk. I mean, when we go into new ventures, whether we're opening a new clinic or starting a new business line, I mean, those are risky propositions where these are very low risk on energy projects. You know, they're almost certainly going to return you what you anticipate. And so that's really where the financial incentive, I think, comes in, that it is almost a guaranteed return.
Operator, do we have any more questions?
We have a question from the line of Lynn Dillavu.
Go ahead, Lynn.
Hi, this is Don Adams. I'm sitting here with Lynn. I think our speakerphone wasn't working last time. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. My budget question or my cost savings question was answered when he said it was versus budget, so that was good. And that's pretty much how we do it. Our other question is we're locked in on natural gas and electricity till June of 2012. And we were looking, wondering the possibility of blend and extends. We're guessing that the same supplier would have to win the reverse auction to do that. But what about reverse auctioning for a period far out like that, far down the line?
You're in California, correct?
Correct.
And so you fall into the being grandfathered for deregulation?
We do, yes, for our five hospital main meter accounts.
Okay. Nick, do you want to answer that question?
Sure. There is a possibility you can buy that far out in advance. If you pursue that approach, what you may find is some of the suppliers may be less excited about participating than others, but yes, auctions can be held way out in the future like that. So that is a possibility, and if you reach out to Gina with the contact information, we can get back to you and talk to you specifically about what kind of activity and what kind of interest we'd get from the suppliers.
From a practical standpoint, the only thing that I may mention, because we've looked out already a little bit, and the pricing goes up pretty quickly the further out you get from the suppliers. So you may have issues just with how much risk they're willing to take given the time out.
Yeah, Vince is exactly right. That sweet spot for suppliers where they feel confident is in that, that 2 to 3 year window. You get, if I remember correctly, Vince, when we had the bids over at your facility, the prices started to climb pretty significantly at the 4 and 5 year, term, right?
Yes.
You know, so they like to stay that sweet spot is that 2 to 3 years out. But if your contract is ending in 2012, you know, you might be able to do a deal right now with prices being low for at least, you know, a 12 to 24 month period. You know, you could it could work out for you, but it is a little bit far out, and it'd be an exploration for you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Do we have another question?
There are no further questions in the queue at this time.
Okay, well, that brings us to the end of our program. We're about a minute past, and we would like to thank everyone, our faculty and everyone on the line, for participating in our program. Just a last reminder to check your email tomorrow for instructions on how to access the recording of this program if you're interested, and also to direct you to all the handouts and articles that you can download from our speakers that they've graciously shared with us. Thank you all for participation. We hope you have a great afternoon. Bye-bye.
This concludes today's teleconference. You may now disconnect.